This is Audible.
Audible Originals presents The Year of Magical Thinking, written by Joan Didion, performed by Vanessa Redgrave.
This happened on December 30, 2003. That may seem a while ago, but it won't when it happens to you. And it will happen to you. The details will be different, but it will happen to you. That's what I'm here to tell you. You see me on this stage. You sit next to me on a plane. You run into me at dinner. You know what happened to me. You don't want to think it could happen to you. That's why I'm here. We had come home. Home meaning an apartment on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. Early evening, maybe 8 o'clock. We discussed whether to go out or eat in. I said we could stay in. I would build a fire. The fire was the point. In California, we heated our houses by building fires. In Malibu, we built fires even on summer evenings because the fog came in. Fires said we were home. We'd drawn the circle. We were safe through the night. I built the fire. I drew the circle. I've no memory of what I meant to have for dinner. Memory stops. The frame freezes. You'll find that's something that happens. John was in his office. I got him a drink. He sat down by the fire to read. He was reading a bound galley of David Franken's Europe's Last Summer, Who Started the Great War in 1914. I set the table in the living room where we could see the fire. I must have noticed that later, the name of the book. I eventually read it myself, but found no clues. Wait. I was telling you what happened. He wanted a second drink. I got it. He asked if I'd used single malt scotch for the second drink. I said I'd used whatever I used for the first drink. Good, he said. I don't know why, but I don't think you should mix them. I was at the table making a salad. He was sitting across from me talking. Either he was talking about why World War I was the event from which the entire rest of the 20th century flowed, or he was talking about the scotch, I've no idea which. Then he wasn't. Wasn't talking. I looked up. I said, "Don't do that." I thought he was making a joke. Slumping over, pretending to be dead. You've seen people make that kind of tiresome joke. Maybe you've done it yourself. Meaning, this was a hard day. We got through it. We're having dinner. We've got a fire. In fact, neither of us had yet said out loud how hard that day had been. My next thought was that he'd started to eat and choked. I tried to move him so I could do the Heimlich. He fell onto the table, then to the floor. There was a dark liquid pooling beneath his face. Within what I now know to have been exactly 5 minutes, two ambulances came. The crews worked on the living room floor for what I now know to have been exactly 45 minutes. I now know these facts because I obtained the documents. I obtained the emergency department nursing documentation sheet. I obtained the nursing flow chart. I obtained the physician's record. I obtained the log kept by the doorman in our building. Paramedics arrived at 9:20 p.m. for Mr. Dunn, the log read. Mr. Dunn was taken to the hospital at 10:05 p.m. The distance from our apartment to the ambulance entrance of New York Cornell is 6 crosstown blocks. I do not remember traffic. I do not remember sirens. When I got out of the ambulance, the gurney was already being pushed inside. Everyone was in scrubs. I noticed one man who was not in scrubs. "Is this the wife?" he said to the driver. Then he looked at me. "I'm your social worker." And I guess that was when I knew. That's something else to remember. If they give you a social worker, you're in trouble. Life changes fast. Life changes in the instant. You sit down to dinner, and life as you know it ends. The question of self-pity. Those were the first words I wrote after it happened. And after that, I'm a writer. But after that, I didn't write anything for a long while. For several weeks after it happened, I tried different strategies for keeping on the correct track. Correct is important to me. One that worked for a while was repeating to myself the last two lines of Rose Aylmer. Walter Savage Landor's 1806 elegy to the memory of a daughter of Lord Aylmer's, who had died at age 20 in Calcutta. I'd not thought of Rose Aylmer since I was at Berkeley, but now I could remember not only the poem, but much of what was said about it in whichever class I heard it analyzed. Ah, what avails the sceptred race? Ah, what the form divine? When every virtue, every grace, Rose Aylmer, all were thine. Rose Aylmer worked, the lecturer said, because the overblown, and therefore meaningless praise in those first lines, gets thrown into a sudden, even shocking relief by what he called the hard, sweet wisdom of the last, which suggest that grief has its place, but also its limits. A night of memories and sighs I consecrate to thee. A night of memories and sighs, he repeated. A night. One night. It might be all night, but he doesn't say all night. He says a night. Not a matter of a lifetime. A matter of some hours. Heart sweet wisdom. Clearly. Since Rose Aylmer remained embedded in my memory, I believed it to offer a lesson for survival. I told you, I knew when I saw the social worker, but I didn't really. Or, more correctly, I knew, but I refused to know. There's a certain kind of personality, my own maybe yours, that sets great store on seeing it straight. For certain of us, this is a big ego point. You might think you'll see it straight, but you won't. You'll be standing in some ER, and at one level you'll have a pretty clear idea of whatever it was that just happened, but you'll see it as a kind of first draft. Notice the evasion there, whatever it was that just happened. The actual words will have vanished from your accessible vocabulary. The only words at hand will have to do with how this can be corrected. Reversible error. If you're a lawyer, you're probably thinking, she doesn't know what reversible error means, but I do. There was a verdict here. Find the right error, and the verdict gets thrown out. And errors are easy to find, if you're me. For example, this is the wrong hospital. This is a perfectly good hospital, but it's not our hospital. It's New York Presbyterian Cornell. Our hospital is New York Presbyterian Columbia, 100 blocks uptown. So while I stand in line to show the insurance cards, nobody told me to stand in this line, but I see it as a constructive step, proof that I'm handling the situation. I tell myself that as soon as he is stabilized, I can move him to Columbia. He will need a bed with telemetry. When I arrange the move, I need to specify this. Notice that only I can do this. I do not distrust those in charge here, but I do feel compelled to manage them. I go further. I see a plan falling into place. Once Quintana is stabilized, I can also move her to Columbia. Maybe I didn't mention this before. New York Cornell is not our first hospital of the evening. The first hospital of the evening was Beth Israel North. You know, the one that used to be Doctor's Hospital, across from Gracie Mansion, where our daughter has been in an induced coma in the sixth floor ICU since Christmas night, with what began as the flu and is now septic shock. Another case of the wrong hospital, from my point of view, but try telling a grown child that the easiest emergency room on the Upper East Side doesn't necessarily add up to the right hospital. Try telling her anything once they sedate her for the endotracheal tube. Must you always have the last word? John said that when we fought, which was often. Must you always be right? For once in your life, just let it go. When we saw her tonight in the ICU, her hair was damp and matted from the fever. I've been trying to brush it since the day after Christmas, but cannot. I could always brush her hair. I could brush her hair even in Malibu, when it was long and bleached from the sun and green from the chlorine in swimming pools, and she'd been in the water all day. She would come up from the beach and John would wrap her in towels on the deck outside his office, and I would brush her hair. I love you more than even one more day, he said to her tonight in the ICU. He said that on each of the 5 nights he saw her there, on the chance she could hear. He said it tonight just before we came home and discussed whether to go out for dinner or eat in, just before I built the fire. No. The lights are too bright in this hospital. It's too cold. If I hold focus, I can arrange for both of them to recuperate at Columbia, adjoining rooms. The McKean Pavilion. I can go up in the afternoons and have tea with them in the atrium while the volunteer pianist and scrubs plays Isn't It Romantic. I can stay until 8, the car will be waiting, I'll come downtown and build a fire and make myself a hamburger. I'll think about John and Quintana in their adjoining rooms, but I'll still have a fire and I'll still eat the hamburger and I'll still watch Chris Matthews on rerun because I will have arranged for them to be safe. I will have brought in the appropriate specialists. I will have made sure that each of these specialists appreciates the entire picture. I will have managed the situation. My social worker reappears. He leads me out of the insurance line and into an empty room away from the triage area. He tells me to wait. Part of my mind is thinking that this does not look good, and part is trying to remember the words on a pink index card I have in my office. When he comes back, he has a sub-teen in a white coat with him. He introduces the sub-teen as your husband's doctor. There's a silence. I hear my own voice. What I hear it saying is this. He's dead, isn't he? The doctor looks at the social worker. It's okay, the social worker says. She's a pretty cool customer. They take me to the cubicle where he is. They ask if I want a priest. I say yes. A priest comes. He says the words. I thank him. They give me the silver clip with John's driver's license and credit cards. They give me the cash from his pocket. They give me his watch. They give me his cell phone. They give me a plastic bag in which they say I will find his clothes. I thank them. The social worker asks if he can do anything more for me. I say he can put me in a taxi. He does. I thank him. He asks if I have money for the fare. I say I do. The cool customer. He uses that word. The fare. Wouldn't it have been more colloquial to say the taxi? Do you have money for the taxi? Wouldn't that have been less troubling? Less as if I was taking some kind of mystery tour? When I walk back into the apartment, I see John's jacket still lying on the chair where he dropped it. I pick it up, a Patagonia windbreaker, the crew jacket from Up Close and Personal. All pictures have crew jackets. There used to be a joke about a picture so bad the crew won't wear the jacket. The dark liquid is still pooled on the living room floor. I see now that it is blood. The EKG electrodes are still on the floor. The empty syringes are still on the floor. The pink index card. I had typed the words on the card for a plot point in a picture we abandoned because we couldn't figure out how the accidental killer, who is also the DA, gets the body out of the house. Here are the words. Tissue anoxia for more than 4 to 6 minutes can result in irreversible brain damage or death. I consider irreversible brain damage. I stop. That isn't exactly what happened. Something else happened, but I can't afford to access the word. There are people I need to call. I can't call Quintana. Quintana's where we left her, unconscious in the ICU, the IV line still dripping the medications that are what they mean when they say we're giving it everything we've got. Everything we've got doesn't do it for me. I want the names. I wrote them down. I looked them up. There were the antibiotics, vancomycin, they call it vanc, by now so do I, azithromycin, gentamicin, clindamycin, then there was Zygris. Zygris is Eli Lilly's drug for septic shock, said to improve the survival rate from 56 to 69%. You might want to file that. For when you are standing by your child's ICU bed and the vanc isn't working and somebody mentions Zygris, spelled X-I-G-R-I-S, pronounced Zygris. This costs $20,000, the nurse said tonight when she changed the IV bag. We still don't know which way this is going, one of the ICU doctors said. Did he say that tonight? Or did he say it last night? You want to know how this happened? John asked that question. A perfectly healthy young woman, married 5 months. She and Jerry had just had their first Thanksgiving dinner. They pureed turnips. They unpacked their wedding china. The weekend before Christmas, she felt terrible. She went with a fever of 103 to the Beth Israel emergency room and was diagnosed with the flu. Stay in bed, drink liquids, it's going around. No chest X-ray was taken. 3 days later, she went back to the emergency room. Her pulse was elevated 150 plus. Her white count was almost zero. There was pneumonia on one lung. She would go to an ICU overnight for monitoring, but it was nothing what we used to call walking pneumonia. By morning, her fever had passed 104. She was intubated. There was pneumonia on both lungs. Her blood pressure was dropping. She had entered septic shock. And they did not know which way it was going. Reconstructing this sequence did not answer John's question. He said, how did this happen? But what he meant was why. If I could answer this question, would he still be? Oh, I decide to make the calls from the bedroom. In the hall outside the bedroom, there's a photograph of John and me taken on a location for the Panic in Needle Park. It was our first picture. We went with it to the Cannes Festival. It was the first time I'd ever been to Europe, and we flew first class on 20th Century Fox, and I boarded the plane barefoot. It was that period, 1971. One or the other of us sent Quintana a postcard every day. She was 5, at home in Malibu. Mon cher Pamplemousse, these postcards began. There is also a photograph of Catherine Ross, taken by Conrad Hall, during the Malibu period when she taught Quintana to swim by throwing a Tahitian shell in a neighbor's pool and telling Quintana that the shell was hers if she brought it up. This was a time when Catherine and Conrad and Jean and Brian Moore and John and I traded plants and dogs and favors and recipes and would have dinner at one or another of our houses a couple of times a week. We all made souffles. Once on Quintana's birthday, I made 2 dozen chocolate souffles and watched 2 dozen 6-year-olds mash them into chocolate pudding. We talked about renting Lee Grant's house above Zuma Beach and opening a restaurant to be called Lee Grant's House. Catherine and Jean and I would take turns cooking, and Conrad and Brian and John would take turns running the front. Conrad Hall is now dead. Brian Moore is now dead. I do not further pursue this update on who is now dead. The telephone rings. It is Lynn Nesbitt. I'm unclear how she knows, but she does, and she's on her way over. This is all happening too fast. I need to discuss this with John. There's nothing I do not discuss with John. I do not always think he's right, nor does he always think I'm right, but we are each the one the other trusts. There is no separation between our interests and investments in any given situation. Many people assume that we must be competitive, that our private life must be a minefield of professional envies and resentments. This is so far from the case that the general insistence on it has come to suggest certain lacunae in the popular understanding of marriage. When Lynn arrives, we do not sit in the part of the living room where the blood and the syringes and the EKG electrodes are still on the floor. She has a telephone in her hand. I realize that she is talking to Christopher Lehmannhaupt. If she's talking to Christopher Lehmannhaupt, she's talking about an obituary in the New York Times. An obituary means he is dead. I am seized by the need to not let anyone at the Los Angeles Times read this in the New York Times. I call a friend at the Los Angeles Times. As he picks up, I realize that I've made a mistake. It's still early in Los Angeles. Is John even dead there? What time was it here when they said he was dead? Is it that time yet in Los Angeles? If there's time left on the West Coast, does it even need to happen there? Should I be taking him there right now? If I hang up and fly out, can we have a different ending on Pacific time? Lynn says she will spend the night. I say no, I'm fine. And I am. Until the morning, when I wake and he still isn't here. Let me make myself clear. Of course I knew he was dead. Of course, I had already delivered the definitive news to the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times. Yet I was myself in no way prepared to accept this news as final. There was a level on which I believed that whatever had happened remained open to revision. That was why I needed to be alone. I needed to be alone so that he could come back. That was the beginning of my year of magical thinking. When I wake and he still isn't here, I try not to move. I lie very still. I analyze the situation. Maybe it takes time for people to come back. Maybe you have to wait. Maybe you need to play along. Maybe you need to make what everyone is calling the arrangements. John's nephew, Tony, comes down from Connecticut to help me. He used to be a construction coordinator on pictures shooting in New York. He knows how to make arrangements. I do not mention to Tony that I am just playing along while I wait. We go to Frankie Campbell, I sign the papers, we bring the clothes, we identify the body. On most surface levels, I seem rational. To the average observer, I would appear to fully understand that death is irreversible. I've authorized an autopsy. I've arranged for cremation. Still, he does not look as if he needs to be dead. He looks pale and a tooth is chipped from the fall, but he's wearing faded jeans and a checked shirt and a navy blue blazer from Sills, and he does not necessarily look dead. If he does not even look dead, he is doing his part. There must be more I need to do. There must be more to this bargain than I know. Further arrangements. It occurs to me that one of those arrangements could be planning a funeral. This funeral part will not be easy. We can't plan a funeral while Q is in a coma. She was christened Quintana, but we call her Q. Or Q-Roo. When she was 16 years old at the Westlake School for Girls in Holmby Hills, he gave her a red car with a plate, Q-Roo. You're safe, I say I'm here. I say it every time I walk into the ICU. I've been saying it to her all her life. The first time I said it was in the nursery at St. John's Hospital in Santa Monica, the day she was born. We took her home and put her in the bassinet overlooking the point with the cave where the sea ran in. If the tide was right and you caught a swell of clear water, you could swim into the cave. After we brought Quintana home, we never did it. The obituaries were already on the wires. We told the resident on duty in the ICU that the television in her room had to be turned off. The resident said that television news could be helpful in maintaining mentation in unconscious patients. We said her father had died. It was a news story. She could not be allowed to learn from CNN that her father was dead. The set was turned off. When we came back that evening, the set was back on. We said it again. The next day, when I walked into the ICU, there was a sign taped up. Dead father, the sign read. No TV. For all I know now, it was a metaphor for how hard I had to work at that hospital to get my point across, to keep her alive. One morning in Malibu, when John and I were having a fight, he took it out on Quintana. She cried. I told her she and I were leaving. She and I were going to LAX. She and I were flying away from him. She told me we couldn't do that to him. Even at 6, did she think herself safer with him than with me? Were they safe only with each other? Would I fail her as I failed him? For all I know now, I imagined that. I continue to wait. I continue to play along. I mention this to no one. For one thing, no one wants to hear it. They want to believe that I'm being strong. To myself, I am invisible, incorporeal. I've crossed one of those rivers that divide the living from the dead. I feel for the first time the power in the image of the rivers, the Styx, the Lethe, the cloaked ferryman with his pole. I saw the ferryman. I heard the ferryman speak. It was the ferryman who asked if I had the fare. He believed he was dying. He told me so repeatedly. I dismissed this. I assured him that he was merely depressed. I said he was being Irish. What did he mean when he said in the taxi that everything he'd done was worthless? Why was he assessing his life? Why was he taking so final a view? What view did I take? What did I say? Did I say the equivalent of don't be ridiculous, don't pull focus, what should we do for dinner? Is that what the living always say to the dying? What should we do for dinner? I'm reading the literature. I'm searching for clues. Philippe Arias, in The Hour of Our Death, points out that death, as it appears in the literature of the Middle Ages, gives advance warning of its arrival, even if sudden or accidental. What did Gawain say when he has asked, Ah, good my lord, think you then so soon to die? I tell you that I shall not live 2 days. And didn't he call that one right? Do they get a message, or do they will it? Do you know what else he said that night? When we were leaving Beth Israel, he said, I don't think I'm up for this. I said, you don't get a choice. I've wondered since if he did. For some months, he had been saying that we weren't having any fun. He meant doing things not because we were expected to do them or had always done them or should do them, but because we wanted to do them. He meant wanting. He meant living. He wanted, for example, to go to Paris. I said, we'd too much to do. He said he had a sense that if he did not go to Paris right now, November, he would never again go to Paris. That settles it then. We're going, I said. Meaning this isn't a discussion anymore. It's blackmail. You just escalated it. All right, you did it. You got the last word, he said as he left the table. We did not speak in any meaningful way for 36 hours. When we resumed speaking, we went to Paris. We walked in the rain in the Luxembourg Gardens. When it got dark at 3 in the afternoon, we swam in the pool on the Bristol roof and watched the lights on the Eiffel Tower. How could I have so missed the signals? Had he not told me? In 1987, his cardiologist was talking about the artery he'd just fixed, the left anterior descending, the LAD. The word I took from this discussion was fixed, restored, cured, a timely and successful intervention. I tell you that I shall not live 2 days. From the last afternoon we swam in the pool on the Bristol roof, he lived 32 days. There came a time when it occurred to me that I was supposed to give away his clothes. Many people had mentioned the necessity for doing this, usually in the guise of offering to help, but I had resisted. I did not need help. I could manage this. I began. I filled many bags with T-shirts, sweatpants, socks, Brooks Brothers shorts. A few weeks later, I assembled more empty bags. I was not yet prepared to address suits or shirts or jackets, but thought I could handle the shoes. I stopped at the door to the room. I could not give away his shoes. I stood there a moment, then realized why. He would need shoes if he was to return. The recognition of this thought by no means eradicated the thought. Magical thinking is a phrase I learned when I was reading anthropology. Primitive cultures operate on magical thinking, if thinking. If we sacrifice the virgin, the rain will come back. If I keep his shoes. I now see the autopsy as an early example of this line of thinking. I wanted the autopsy. In the course of doing research, I'd watched autopsies. I knew exactly what happens, the face peeled down, the chest open like a chicken in a butcher's case. I still wanted the autopsy. In fact, I wanted to be in the room when they did it. But I didn't think I could present this point rationally, so I didn't ask. Here was my reasoning, which for some months remained hidden even from me. An autopsy could show that what had gone wrong was no more than a transitory blockage or arrhythmia. If so, the reasoning went, they might be able to fix it. Quintana's out of the hospital. We can do the funeral. St. John the Divine, a Catholic priest and an Episcopal priest, Gregorian chant. Jerry walked Quintana to the pulpit, still weak but standing very straight in a black dress in the same cathedral where she had 8 months before been married. She read a poem she'd written to her father. I love you more than even one more day, she said. Everyone except Quintana referred to John in the past tense. I had succeeded. I had convinced them. They had said goodbye. I'd played along. I'd followed the ritual. I'd made the arrangements. I'd acknowledged that he was dead. I'd done this in as public a way as I could conceive. Why didn't he come back? After Quintana said, I love you more than even one more day, she said something else. This is what she said. As you used to say to me. Yes, many people have pointed out that John and Quintana and I were unusually dependent on one another. Is unusual dependency another way of saying marriage? Husband and wife? Parent and child? On the occasion when John gave Q the red car with the Q Rue plate, I gave her a gold Tiffany bangle. Like this one. The day I'd finally told Quintana her father was dead was January 15, 2004, the day the sedation had been sufficiently metabolized to remove the endotracheal tube. I did not intend to tell her that day. I did not intend even to see her. If she saw me, she would ask where her father was, and I would have to tell her. Our plan was that she would wake and see her husband, Jerry, and for as many hours or days as she was in and out, she would not think to ask where her mother and father were. We conveyed this plan to the ICU team. We got the ICU team on board. Nevertheless, she was barely awake when an aide volunteered that her mother was just down the hall. She asked the logical question. If she's just down the hall, she whispered, then why doesn't she come in? Where's Dad? She whispered when she saw me. I told her. I stressed the long history of cardiac problems, the apparent suddenness but actual inevitability of the event. She cried. Jerry and I each held her. She tried to talk. She believed she'd spent the past months in Taipei. The space shuttle to Tokyo had developed mechanical difficulties and been diverted to Taipei. She dropped back into sleep. How's Dad? She whispered when I saw her that evening. I told her again. But how is he now? She had absorbed the event, but not the outcome. That was the flaw in the story I was telling. I could never make the outcome convincing. In the end, I would have to tell her again. In another intensive care unit. This one at UCLA. Let me do some chronology here, just to assure you I can still do dates. Neurologists are very big on dates, I would learn later, when they kept asking Q what the date was, and I never knew myself. When it was all I could do to get up in the morning and do the crossword with breakfast, one more thing to remember. Mornings are when you need to mount a frontal assault on the self-pity question. Get out of bed, eat breakfast, work the crossword, memorize the date, walk briskly into the unit, and go hand-to-hand with whichever resident is hapless enough to get caught in your eyeline. If you want to manage this case, I'm signing off, one of them finally said to me. I counted that a victory. Must you always be right? John said that in Malibu. The morning I told Q we would go to LAX and fly away from him. We can't do that to him, she said. And we didn't. We stayed. It was he who walked out of the house in Malibu that particular morning, slammed the kitchen door, shot 0-60 onto the PCH in my Corvette. Must you always have the last word? Can you once in your life just let it go? Why was I the one who had to let it go? Since I was the one in charge of assembling the facts, since I was the one who cross-checked the EMT records against the emergency department nursing documentation sheet, against the nursing flowchart, against the log kept by the doorman, which is how I happen to know that the ambulances arrived exactly 5 minutes after I called them, which is also how I happen to know that the crews worked on the living room floor for exactly 45 minutes, which is also how I happen to know that at the time of triage, she was asystolic, apneic, had no pulse via sonography, and had a Glasgow Coma Scale rating of 3, indicating that eye, verbal, and motor responses were all absent. Clearly, I'm not on top of the self-pity question. Am I failing to understand this as something that happened to him? Am I still understanding it as something that happened to me? The crossword clue that first gets my attention this morning is 6 down. Sometimes you feel like... I instantly see the answer, a good long one that will for many spaces improve my competence for the day. A motherless child. Sometimes you feel like a motherless child. No. 6 down has only 4 letters. I abandon the puzzle and look up the answer. The correct answer for 6 down is A-N-U-T. A nut. Sometimes you feel like a nut. How far have I absented myself from the world of normal response? Notice the answer most instantly accessed, a motherless child, is a wail of self-pity. The chronology, the dates. On Saturday, March 25, 2 days after we put John's ashes in the vault at St. John the Divine, Quintana and Jerry flew to California to spend a few days in Malibu. I encouraged this. I even pressed it. When she wondered if she was well enough, I spoke of how restorative it would be to walk on the beach. I wanted to see Malibu color on her face and hair again. I had another reason. I wanted her to be a child again. Well, I will tell you one thing about slamming the kitchen door and walking out of a house in Malibu and hitting the PCH at 60 in your wife's Corvette. Unless you've got all day to make your statement, there's nowhere to go, so you tend to come back and finish the picture you wanted to quit, which, as I recall, was the issue in that particular walkout. Quintana, Malibu, March 25. I talked to her before she left. She sounded anxious. She always sounded anxious before a trip. "Do you think I'll be okay in California?" she asked. I said yes, definitely she would be okay in California. In January, I had watched ice flows on the East River from a window at Beth Israel North. In February, I had watched ice flows on the Hudson from a window at Columbia Presbyterian. Now, in March, the ice was gone, and Quintana would come back from Malibu restored. That afternoon, I imagined her already walking on the beach. Her plane would have landed. They would have picked up a car and driven up the Pacific Coast Highway. There would be wild mustard on the hills. She could take Jerry to see the orchids at Zuma Canyon. She could take him to eat fried fish at the Ventura County Line. She could take him to lunch at Jean Moore's. She could show him where she'd played tennis, where she'd learned from the Zuma lifeguards how to swim out of a riptide. On the desk in my office, there is a photograph taken when she was 7 or 8, her hair white from the sun. stuck in the frame as a crayoned note left one day on the kitchen counter in Malibu. "Dear Mom," the note read, "when you opened the door, it was me who ran away. XXXXXQ. At 7:10, that evening, Tony called. He said he was on his way over. I noted the time because I was due for dinner at 7:30, but his urgency was such that I did not say so. His wife had been ill. As he was about to hang up, I asked if Rosemary was back in the hospital. He said it was not Rosemary, it was Quintana. They'd gotten off the plane. They'd picked up their shared bag. Jerry was carrying the bag to the car rental shuttle, crossing the arrivals driveway ahead of her. He turned around. She was lying on her back on the asphalt. Life changes in the instant, the ordinary instant. I checked to see who was still flying to Los Angeles. Delta had a 940 out of Kennedy. I was picking up the phone to call Delta when Tony said he did not think being in flight during the surgery was a good idea. I put down the phone. Midline shift, brain pushed to left side, massive arterial bleed, blood everywhere like a geyser, no clotting factor. One pupil was fixed and the other went as we wheeled her in. Those are some of the things, the neurosurgeon said, when I did get to Los Angeles. I walked into the ICU. She was in a coma. The neurosurgeon said the coma could continue for days or weeks. The bleed into her brain could have been caused by the fall, or the fall could have been caused by the bleed. New problems could present themselves in the immediate days ahead. Those problems included, but were not limited to, seizures, fever, infection, emboli, pneumonias, and further swelling in the brain, which would require further surgery. Half her skull was stapled, the staple still oozing blood. You're safe. I'm here. Have you noticed the way people always describe the ordinary nature of the circumstances in which the disaster occurred? The clear blue sky from which the plane fell? The way children were playing on the swings as usual when the rattlesnake struck from the ivy? John and I were married on the afternoon of January 30, 1964, a Thursday, at the Catholic Mission of San Juan Bautista in San Benito County, California. John wore a navy blue suit from Chip. I wore a short white silk dress I bought at Ransohoff's in San Francisco the day John Kennedy was killed. My plan for San Juan Bautista was to have no entrance, no procession, just stand up there and do it. It never occurred to me to take off my dark glasses. I thought about that wedding on the day of Quintana's wedding. She wore a long dress and a veil and expensive shoes, but her hair was in a thick braid down her back, as it had been when she was a child in Malibu. We sat in the choir at St. John the Divine. There were small girls with leis barefoot. There were watercress sandwiches, champagne, pink lemonade, peacocks on the lawn. She kicked off her expensive shoes and unpinned the veil. "Wasn't that just about perfect?" she said when she called that evening. July 26, 2003. All gone. Over. In another world. I cannot think of what is gone. If I think of what is gone, the difference between then and now will take me. I won't be there when she needs me. "When do you have to leave?" she asked at UCLA the day she could finally speak. I promised I would not leave until we could leave together. It occurred to me that this had been since the day she was born, my basic promise to her. I would not leave. The neurologists who ask her what day it is also ask her what city it is. One day she gets it, although not the next. I report this limited advance to a friend who calls. He asks for the prognosis. I notice his uneasiness when I have none to offer. That doesn't matter to me. If I can keep her alive, John will come back. He and I will go to Paris again. She and Jerry will have Thanksgiving again. I'm keeping her alive. And to keep her alive, I need to focus. I need to avoid noticing anything that might lead me back into the past. Going back has trick currents, unrevealed eddies. You can be skimming along on what looks like clear water and suddenly go under. Get sucked down. Get caught in the vortex and let go of a hand. Lose control. Lose her. Feel the water take her. I first identified this vortex effect when I was watching the ice flows from Beth Israel North. There happened to be a rose-patterned wallpaper border left from the period when Beth Israel North was Doctor's Hospital. Doctor's Hospital led directly to someone I knew when I was working for Vogue. A woman who moved through the Condé Nast offices trailing clouds of cigarette smoke and Chanel No. 5, an imminent disaster. This seems a safe line of thinking. Clear water. I sail on. I should see it coming, but I don't. I used a version of this character in Play It As It Lays, because there was a snake on the jacket of Play It As It Lays. Quintana called it Mommy's Snake Book. I recognize too late that I've entered marked water with Mommy's Snake Book. I was writing that book when Quintana was 3. Quintana at 3. I am in the vortex. The night she put a seed pod up her nose and we drove her to Children's Hospital, the pediatrician who specialized in seed pods arrived in his dinner jacket. The next night she put another seed pod up her nose, wanting to repeat the interesting adventure. John and I walking around the lake in MacArthur Park, the old man lurching from the bench. That child is the picture of Ginger Rogers, the old man cried. I finish the novel. I'm under contract to begin a column for Life. We take her to Honolulu. Life's idea for the first column is that I should tell the readers who I am. I plan to write it from Honolulu, but once we are there, the My Lai massacre breaks. It seems clear that I should forget telling the readers who I am. I should go instead to Saigon and do My Lai. I call my editor. He instructs me to stay in Honolulu and tell the readers who I am, that as far as Saigon goes, some of the guys are going out. I warned you, John says. I told you what working for Life would be like. Didn't I tell you? It would be like being nibbled to death by ducks. I'm brushing Quintana's hair, the picture of Ginger Rogers. I feel betrayed, humiliated. I should have listened to John. See where that particular vortex sucked me? From the wallpaper border at Beth Israel North to Quintana at 3, and I should have listened to John. I tell you that I shall not live 2 days, Gawain said. You will have divined that the hard, sweet wisdom of Rose Aylmer is now lost on me. I need more than a night of memories and sighs. I need him back. I need him to hold on to her in the water. I see immediately in Los Angeles that its potential for triggering this vortex effect can be controlled only by avoiding any venue I might associate with either John or Quintana. This will require ingenuity. She was born here. John and I lived here most of the time we were married. Even after we moved to New York, we spent weeks at a time here, usually at the very hotel in which I'm now staying, the Beverly Wilshire. For reasons that remain unclear, the Beverly Wilshire itself only rarely triggers the vortex effect. Outside the Beverly Wilshire, I plot my routes. I remain on guard. Never once in 5 weeks do I drive up the Pacific Coast Highway. Not driving to Malibu means John can still be wrapping Quintana in towels on the deck outside his office. Not driving to Malibu means her hair can still be bleached from the sun and green from the chlorine in swimming pools. I even avoid driving to UCLA on Sunset. Sunset was how we drove to Malibu. I avoid tuning the car radio to the stations I used to drive by. I avoid KRLA, an AM station that when I was driving to Malibu called itself the heart and soul of rock and roll. Instead, I listen to NPR, a sedate morning show called Morning Becomes Eclectic. Every morning at the Beverly Wilshire, I order the same breakfast, huevos rancheros with only one scrambled egg. Every morning when I drive to UCLA on Wilshire, I notice the same banners on the light standards. UCLA Medical Center, first in the West, third in the nation. Every morning I wonder whose ranking this is. I never ask. In the deep hush of Morning Becomes Eclectic, I congratulate myself. I am outmaneuvering the vortex. The trick is to remain flexible. Take the morning I need to buy bottled water at the Rite Aid and turn up Cannon. I see trouble ahead, but I've already turned up Cannon. Cannon is where the bistro used to be. When Quintana was 6 or 7, John and I took her to the bistro for a birthday lunch. She was wearing a lime green ruana I brought her from Bogota. Que bonita, que hermosa, the busboys crooned. I realize that if I continue up Cannon, I will be walking through the Rite Aid in tears. There's also the blood running down my leg. I just noticed the blood. The blood must have something to do with trying to use the self-serve island at the Union 76 on Wilshire this morning. That did not go well. If I walk into the Rite Aid in this condition, someone will alert security. Tears, blood, aisle 3. Scratch bottled water. Order bottled water from room service. Did she ever read Play It As It Lays? Did she ever read anything we wrote? I don't mean dutifully turning the pages and saying, very good, really interesting. I mean, actually read it. John asked her that once. I never would have. This was her answer. When you read something, you make a judgment on it, and you don't want to make a judgment on your mother and father. Very good. Really interesting. Were we always so afraid of each other? What were we afraid of? Does she know I still see her as a child? I'm driving west on Santa Monica to see a dermatologist about my leg. Exactly, still bleeding. Precisely, I should have gotten a stitch, but I had to get to UCLA. In any case, I'm on my way to this dermatologist for what they're now calling wound care when I see that road work will force me to take San Vicente. If I take San Vicente, I will pass within 3 blocks of the house in Brentwood Park to which we moved when Quintana started Westlake. I tried to catch this one early. I take out my cell phone on Santa Monica Boulevard and reschedule the appointment. What I do next makes no sense at all. What I do next is everything I've been working not to do. I take the detour I cannot take. I lose all control. I stop the car in San Vicente. I let the vortex take me. There are girls in school uniforms outside the Brentwood Mart, so it must be after school. Hours must have passed. How long have I been gone? Did she wake? Does she think I left her? She could be alone, thinking I broke the promise. Pleated uniform skirts chopped off into minis. Angel 10th graders pushing the dress code. Black wing, brown wing, hover over. 20 years and the spring is over. I would read her that poem to go to sleep. In the back of a closet, I still have one of her chopped-off Westlake skirts, along with her St. John's Hospital volunteer pinafore and a black challis dress I bought her when she was 3. Today grieves, tomorrow grieves, cover me over, light in leaves. She always woke in Malibu when the tide turned and the sea went silent. This was never supposed to happen to her. When I got to the hospital today, I could not find a parking place on the Plaza 4 level. Plaza 4 means you park outside, not in the structure. Plaza 4 is important to me. Plaza 4 represents a routine. On Plaza 4, you park against the hedge and you leave your pass on the dashboard and you lock the car and you walk up the terraces to the lobby, and by the time you get there, you are ready, prepared. You have willed this day to go as you need it to go. This morning when I could not find the parking place, I lost that sequence. I sat in the car waiting for space, and I realized that I cannot will her to be safe. I saw the extent to which I've been operating on magic. If I follow the rules, if I learn the language... I followed the rules. I learned the language. I learned how to assess kidney function by the lab values. I learned how the placement of a screen in the vena cava prevents emboli from stopping the heart. I learned the significance of midline shift, fixed and dilated pupils, the difference between a methicillin-resistant staph A hospital infection and a methicillin-resistant staph E hospital infection, and what it will mean when each becomes resistant to FANC. And I still can't keep her safe. What was in my mind when I bought the blue cotton scrubs at the UCLA Medical Center bookstore? Did it never occur to me that for the mother of a patient to show up at the hospital wearing blue cotton scrubs could only be construed as a suspicious violation of boundaries? Has my isolation become this profound? Must you always be right? Must you always have the last word? I certainly don't have it now, do I? If I can get her pronounced stable and discharged, I can remove her from here. We have had enough of IVs and PICC lines and CAT scans and swallow tests. See where they're getting us? Nowhere. She needs to be in the water. She needs to let what hair she has go green from the chlorine. They cut off half her hair in the OR and the rest got cut in the ICU, but it is already growing back. Baby hair, feathers, like a duck. We can get her hair properly washed at the Beverly Wilshire. We can sit by the pool and have our nails done together. You think I'm crazy? You think I'm crazy because otherwise I'm dangerous. Radioactive. If I'm sane, what happened to me could happen to you. You don't want to hear what I have to tell you. You want me to give you a good prognosis. I can't. So it's safer to think I'm crazy. Fine. It doesn't matter to me. I was crazy for a while, but I'm not now. After 5 weeks, they've pronounced her stable enough to be transferred for neurorehabilitation. This transfer will require trained medical personnel. Arrangements are made to medevac her, an ambulance from UCLA to an airport, an air ambulance to Teterboro, and an ambulance from Teterboro to the Rusk Institute at NYU. Records are faxed. A CD-ROM of CAT scans is prepared. A date is set. Friday, April 30. The day of the flight unfolds with the non-sequential inexorability of a dream. There is the question of whether the plane is at Santa Monica or Burbank or Van Nuys. There is the insistence of the ambulance attendant that since no plane is in sight, we must be going by helicopter. I don't think so, I say. It's 3,000 miles. The plane is finally located, a jet Cessna with room for two pilots, two paramedics, the stretcher to which Quintana is strapped, and if I sit on the bench over the oxygen canisters, me. We take off. I have with me a red suede Prada bag she was carrying the day she flew to California. When I opened the safe at the Beverly Wilshire this morning, I took out the plastic pouch reading UCLA Medical Center's specimen for laboratory and put it in the Prada bag. By smoothing the plastic, I can see what they sealed inside while they were taking her into surgery. Her watch and her wedding rings and the little diamond earrings Susan Traylor's mother gave her. When Quintana was part of Susan's family and Susan part of ours. When Susan would go to Honolulu with us. One morning in Honolulu, John insisted that Susan and Quintana come in from the water and go with us to the Honolulu courthouse where we were following a prostitution trial. It was his way of keeping them safe from drowning. Improvised, like everything else in our life. Flying blind. Why did I think this improvisation could never end? I put something else in Quintana's bag this morning, the copy of Clinical Neuroanatomy I bought at the UCLA Medical Center bookstore when I could not understand what the doctors were saying. This book has been by my bed at the Beverly Wilshire for 5 weeks, and I still do not understand what the doctors are saying. I do not even understand the Gilded Boy story. A mysterious test for memory and comprehension that appears in Appendix A, the Neurologic Examination. The patient should be told the Gilded Boy story, according to Appendix A, and then asked to retell it and explain its meaning. Quote, at the coronation of one of the popes, about 300 years ago, a little boy was chosen to play the part of an angel. So far, clear enough, although potentially troubling details for someone emerging from coma. The narrative continues, so that his appearance might be as magnificent as possible, he was covered from head to foot with gold foil. The little boy fell ill, and although everything possible was done for his recovery, he died within a few hours. What is the meaning of the Gilded Boy story? Does it have to do with the fallibility of the popes? With the fallibility of authority in general? Given that everything possible was done for his recovery, does it have to do with the specific fallibility of medicine? What possible point could there be in telling this story to a patient immobilized in a neuro-ICU at a major teaching hospital? Do they think that because it's a story, it can be told without consequence? It occurs to me that the Gilded Boy story represents, in its utter impenetrability and apparent disregard for the sensitivity of the patient, the entire situation that Quintana and I are right now leaving behind. We fly for a while. I keep checking the bag to make sure I've not lost her rings. I have her rings. I have her. It might take 6 weeks or even the whole summer and fall, but she will play tennis again. She will take pictures again. She will swim out of a riptide. I turn my attention to the paramedics. One of them has a digital camera and is taking pictures of what he keeps calling the Grand Canyon. I correct him. I say it is not the Grand Canyon, but Lake Mead, Hoover Dam. I point out Las Vegas. He continues taking pictures. He also continues calling it the Grand Canyon. All right, I think. It's the Grand Canyon. I shift position on the bench so I can no longer see out the window. We land in a cornfield in Kansas to refuel. The pilots strike a deal with the two teenagers who manage the strip. During the refueling, they will take their pickup to a McDonald's and bring back hamburgers. While we wait, I walk to where the tarmac ends and the corn begins. There's a little rain and unstable air, and I imagine a tornado coming. John wrote a tornado into his last novel. 6 weeks after he died, I read The Galleys. In the passage about the tornado, there was what could have been a typo, a dropped word. I considered adding the word, but did not. If I added a word he did not want, he might not come back. Today, at the end of the tarmac, I realize something. I am no longer waiting for him to come back. That's gone. I lost it. He's dead. He can't come back. He can't hold on to her in the water. Any more than she and I can go back to Malibu. The Malibu house was a teardown, as was the house in Brentwood Park. Black wing, brown wing, hover over. 20 years and the spring is over. What exactly was wrong with thinking he could come back? Wasn't it getting us through this? What can get us through this now? Back in the plane, I take one of the hamburgers from the McDonald's bag and tear it into pieces so that Quintana and I can share. After a few bites, she shakes her head. She's been allowed solid food for only a week and cannot eat more. There's still a feeding tube in place in case she cannot eat at all. Am I going to make it? She asks then. I choose to believe that she's asking if she will make it to New York. Definitely, I say. Definitely you will be okay in California, I said 5 weeks ago. That night, when we arrive at NYU, Jerry and Tony are standing outside to meet the ambulance. Jerry asks how the flight was. I say we shared a Big Mac in a cornfield in Kansas. It wasn't a Big Mac, Quintana says. It was a quarter pounder. Do you remember I said I gave her a bracelet like this one? I gave her this one. I have the Prada bag, too. And the black dress she bought for John's funeral. I sent the dress to Susan Traylor, and the little diamond earring Susan's mother gave Quintana. How did this happen? On the 15th of July, 2004, she'd been discharged from the Rusk Institute to continue neurorehabilitation on an outpatient basis. A week later, I went back to work. Because I was committed to write a piece about the campaign, I flew to Boston for the Democratic Convention. When it was time to stand for the national anthem, I could see myself pitching forward in free fall. I became convinced that the Fleet Center escalators were locked to prevent my exit. I watched the rest of the convention on C-SPAN. I realized that I was, in fact, in freefall, rendered incapable, gone. That I was only then beginning the process of mourning did not occur to me. I began making notes. They became a book. Because the book was about events that touched the heart of Quintana's life, and of which she had no first-hand memory, I asked her to read the manuscript. She said it was very good. Really interesting. Had we all along been distant from each other? Or had we each been too acutely aware of how it would be to lose the other? In June 2005, she was admitted to another ICU through another ER, this one at Cornell, the same ER where her father had been pronounced dead on arrival. She had been at home with Jerry. Sunday lunch, sudden nausea, probably a stomach bug. It's going around. The less casual diagnosis was acute pancreatitis, followed by septic shock. We were back to Vank. We were back to Zygris. At Beth Israel, she'd gone to the edge of death. At UCLA, she'd again gone to the edge. Does going that close leave its mark? Are you ever again as you were? Or does the damage hide, pick its time, line up its target, kick back in just when you think you're safe, say at Sunday lunch with your husband, a lazy afternoon, the time's half red? Don't let the broken man catch me, she would say, when she was 3 or 4 and woke from bad dreams. If the broken man comes, I'll hang on to the fence and not let him take me. She let go of the fence on August 26, 2005. There were days in July when everyone said we're really very hopeful. There was the promise of a step-down unit. Physical therapists came by. Psychiatric residents came by. The last day she was awake, she was perfectly lucid but anxious, the way she was before her trip. They were taking her down for a procedure. You're going to be fine, I said. It's nothing. It's diagnostic. They'll find out what's wrong and they'll fix it. Definitely you'll be okay in California. You're safe. I'm here. If you have never seen this happen, you won't believe it's going to happen. They will have been telling you for days that it could happen, could meaning will, but you won't have believed it. Somewhere in there, someone will have said something like, "We're not giving up on this." And that's what you will have heard. You'll come into the ICU as usual one morning, and there'll be 15 or 20 people in scrubs and masks and gowns and gloves, and one of them will say you can't come in. Then the attending will notice you and come out, and he'll mention the 16 units of blood they've used since the numbers started dropping, and the 4 more on their way, and he'll explain that they're doing hand compression because the vent can't get enough oxygen into the lungs, and then he'll take you in, and he won't seem to care about the mask and the gown and the gloves, and that's when you'll know. Except you won't really. Am I going to make it? She asked me in the cornfield in Kansas. Definitely, I promised. I watched the river as it happened. Have you ever wondered why the ICUs in New York hospitals have such high rent river views? Why you can watch the tide turn in the East River from the ICUs at Cornell? Why you can watch the sea surge press back the Hudson from the ICUs at Columbia. I have a few more questions I need to ask her. Did I lie to you? Did I lie to you all your life? When I said you're safe, I'm here. Was that a lie or did you believe it? Is a lie only a story that the hearer disbelieves? Is that the only definition of a lie? Or did you believe it? There was one Christmas. We were in Honolulu doing a crash rewrite on a picture that never got made. On that particular Christmas, we ordered Mai Mai and Manoa lettuce vinaigrette from room service. We tried for a holiday effect by arranging leis over the printers and computers we were using for the rewrite. We found candles and lit them. John fell asleep about 11:30. Quinton and Susan went downstairs to see what was happening. I could see John sleeping. I knew Quinton and Susan were safe. They'd been going downstairs to see what was happening in this hotel since they were 7. I had a sense of well-being so profound that I did not want to go to sleep. Everyone was so safe that I could sit on a balcony overlooking the Wailea Country Club golf course and finish the wine we drank with dinner and watch neighborhood fireworks all over Honolulu. I told you I wrote a book. Grief turns out to be a place none of us know until we reach it. We know that someone close to us could die. We might expect to feel shock. We do not expect the shock to be obliterative, dislocating to both body and mind. We might expect to be prostrate, inconsolable, crazy with loss. We do not expect to be literally crazy. Cool customers who believe that their husband is about to return and need his shoes. Nor can we know ahead of the fact. And here lies the heart of the difference between grief as we imagine it and grief as it is. The unending absence that follows. The void. The relentless succession of moments during which we will confront the experience of meaninglessness itself. I went on to explain that as a child I thought a great deal about meaninglessness, which seemed at the time the most prominent negative feature on the horizon. After a few years of failing to find meaning in the more commonly recommended venues, I learned that I could find it in geology, so I did. This in turn enabled my 10-year-old mind to find meaning in the Episcopal Litany, most acutely in the words, "As it was in the beginning, is now and ever shall be, world without end." I interpreted these words as a literal description of the constant changing of the earth, the unending erosion of the shores and mountains, the inexorable shifting of the geological structures that could throw up mountains and islands and could just as reliably take them away. No eye was on the sparrow. No one was watching me. I still believe this. After this book was published, many people asked me if this view had not changed, been modified, if what I'd been through, this was always a phrase, had not offered me a more comforting version of the meaning of life and death. Comforting was always the word. When I'm asked this question, I consider the solace I found in geology. In its promise that the world will change but also continue, do I still find that solace? How about those river views from the ICUs? Those eddies, those tidal bores, those currents, those flows. As it was in the beginning, is now and ever shall be. World without end. Do we get more comfort than that? We all know that if we're to live ourselves, there comes a time when we must relinquish the dead, let them go, keep them dead, let them become the photograph on the table, let them become the name on the trust accounts, let go of them in the water. Knowing this does not make it any easier to let go of them in the water. I did not want the year after either of them died to end. I knew that as the second year began and the days passed, my sense of John and Quintana alive, would become more remote, softened, transmuted into whatever best served my life without them. In fact, this is already happening. For once in your life, just let it go. During the years when people still left Honolulu on the Matson lines, the custom at the moment of departure was to throw leis on the water, a promise that the traveller would return. The leis would get caught in the wake and grow bruised and brown. Leis go brown. Tectonic plates shift. Deep currents change. I think about bringing her home from St. John's Hospital in Santa Monica and placing her in the bassinet that overlooked the point where the sea ran into the cave into which we never again swam after the day we brought her home. One more way of keeping her from drowning. You're safe. I'm here. He checked every few minutes to see if she was breathing. When she was 5 days old, he christened her himself in a sink, just in case she didn't live until we could do the ceremony. She did live that long. She lived long enough to stand up in her black dress at his funeral and say, "I love you more than even one more day, as you used to say to me." Maybe she did. Maybe he did. I think about swimming with him into that cave, about the swell of clear water, the way it changed, the swiftness and power it gained as it narrowed through the rocks at the base of the point. The tide had to be just right. We had to be in the water at the very moment the tide was right. We could only have done this a half dozen times at most during the 2 years we lived there, but it is what I remember. Each time we did it, I was afraid of missing the swell, hanging back, timing it wrong. He never was. You had to feel the swell change. You had to go with the change. He told me that. No eye is on the sparrow, but he did tell me that.
This has been an Audible Originals production of The Year of Magical Thinking, written by Joan Didion, performed by Vanessa Redgrave, executive producer Kate Navin, producer Abigail Gonda, dialect coach Joan Washington, engineered by Mark Appleby at Goldcrest Post Production, post-production for Audible Studios by Tim Kim and Jeff Dudzik. Vice President of Audible Studios, Mike Charzik. Copyright 2005 by Joan Didion. Sound recording copyright 2020 by AO Media LLC.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.